Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast, supporting you on your mothering journey during pregnancy, birth and beyond. Through yoga, education and community, we enable every woman we work with to connect more deeply to herself and her own innate wisdom. Find your tribe as you become a parent, making positive, informed choices that are right for you, because Lush Tums believes everything has a place. Join the two Claires as we connect, laugh and learn. In this space, everything is welcome. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Claire McGill.
And I'm Claire Maddalena.
Today we're joined by someone very special.
Dominic Sikorski moved to Bristol 28 years ago working as an active birth teacher. She then trained as a therapist, initially working at Relate, supporting couples and families in the UK's first family counselling service. She has trained doulas and antenatal educators all over the world and is author of the book The Seven Secrets of a Joyful Birth.
Welcome, Dominique. It's lovely to have you.
Hi, lovely to be here.
So lovely to meet you, Dom. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Well, really looking forward to sharing with you, and where would be a good place to start?
Oh, let's start with your journey to begin with. So how did your career begin? What were you doing before you became a mum?
So I will say that I was pregnant with my first child when I was 22. So I hadn't had a great long career of any sort. I'd hardly got going, you could say. I was working in education and welfare when and before that, magazine production. So not so very related. Then I got into the welfare educational stuff. But it was having my first child. I'd just had my 23rd birthday when I had him. And it was having him really that kind of set me on a totally new direction, as I think often birth and motherhood can do. And I feel like it kind of got me on track to a more authentic place as to where I would work from. So big changes really from the pregnancy.
Amazing.
So what was your birth experience like? Was it the birth experience itself or the pregnancy?
I come from a family of seven kids and my mum was always having a baby because they went on a spread over 21 years. So there was a lot of babies about. And I don't think I really thought about it when I was pregnant. When I look back, I would say I was very stressed at that time of my life, actually. Housing was difficult in London and I was quite stressed with all of that. And I think that the pregnancy was difficult towards the end, and that he was induced 5 weeks premature because they thought I had preeclampsia. In fact, he was, 6 pounds two and didn't need special care or anything. So he was remarkably resilient. I happened to be going to classes at the Active Birth Centre in Tufnell Park with Janet Belaskis, who's the founder of the Active Birth movement, and brought yoga to the West, really, for pregnancy. I always think she's a remarkable woman. And I happened to be going to her classes, had the birth, which on paper didn't look difficult. It was an induction 5 weeks premature, and there wasn't an enormous amount of interventions that happened after I got going. But for me, I think I found it very shocking. And on reflecting on that, when I was in postnatal classes, which was really helpful, I then started to train to be an active birth teacher. It was just around the corner from me and it all sort of made sense. And then I worked for quite a long time at the Active Birth Centre. And I think birth kind of could go in so many different directions. So it sort of set me on a course of where I'm at now, really. I think if you're working with birth, you're working with the whole family. So,
oh wow! So you were with Janet, kind of right at the beginning. I've read all her stuff.
Yes, I was, and I still work with her. Before pandemic, we were in Istanbul together doing a bit of teaching. So, and I think she's so powerful and passionate still now. And it was a real, it was just luck really that I was there, because I don't know if I would have related to my own birth in such a vulnerable way if I hadn't had that kind of gaze and lens and opportunity. And that was actually really helpful, because it probably was traumatic to me, even if it didn't look traumatic on paper. I guess I found certain aspects of it really a bit shocking. And I think birth is a strong event. And then when I had my second child, I actually was having supper with Janet when I went into labour. Coincidentally, and Michelle O'Dont, because they were having like a birth celebration supper. And then I went home and just had the baby without the midwife getting there or anything. I think probably because I thought this is just too unreal. I can't really be going into labour. And then boom, he was there. So
Can you imagine the oxytocin round that table with you, Janet and Michelle?
And then my last child is a Bristolian child. She's my Bristol girl, and she was born in Bristol at home in the woods in Coombe Dingle, pretty much, in the house that I was living in at the time. So.
Oh, wonderful, yeah. Wonderful. Oh, I had the opportunity to meet Janet and Michelle at Findhorn's conference in 2016, the Healthy Birth, Healthy Earth one.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Real elders, I believe, of the birth movement.
I absolutely agree. And I really felt at that event and from reading all their work for years and years that there's a certain bit of the baton that got passed on. I feel like I'm carrying a bit of their torch.
I love that you are. That just is going to be of such service and help to all of your clients.
Thank you, Dom.
How did you find motherhood? Was your second child born quite close to your first?
No, they were actually like 3 years, I think, and 3 months apart. I actually had a miscarriage in between. And I would say, on the one hand, coming from a family of seven children, I was very used to toddlers and babies being around because there often was. I was in the first three, and then, like I say, my mum went on for 21 years having babies. So I was probably much more used to babies than I realised, in a way. But I still think it was a massive transition. And, you know, it is a big change. I don't think anything else could be more of a transition, in a way, than that. You know, getting your life on track, you know, the actual lived experience of getting your life into a shape that accommodates a whole new human being who's there 24/7 is wild and phenomenal. I really don't think any other transition would kind of touch the sides pretty much of that. I think I had normal struggles and also lots of joys. You know, I did love being a mum of young kids. And then I had a third child, 7, 3, and then the third one. So I was quite spread out, actually. So, but I also think that mothering got me on track in that it changed my course of my career. Like I said, I started training with the Active Birth Centre and moving away from the educational organisations and stuff where I'd been working in welfare. And I just think that when you have a child, because it's difficult to organise childcare and get all of that set up, it can put a stronger lens on how you spend your time when you're not with the child.
Absolutely.
I didn't want to do something unless I really wanted to do it. And I might not have been the most business-minded person in that way, but I was always somebody who was going to follow my passion. So I kind of put that probably before thinking in a business head type way. But I feel like actually it's taken me on a good trajectory. And then I trained in 1999 to be a craniosacral therapist, and then I started training and working at Relate. I kind of feel like birth is a relational event, and therefore it kind of made sense in a way just to expand knowledge. And I guess I saw all my lovely families, you know, sometimes there'd be a single parent in the pregnancy class, of course, and that could feel quite vulnerable at that time for that person, especially if they're around a lot of people who seem to be in idyllic, inverted commas, relationships. Of course, the statistics would say that X many years after that class, X many percent of those people are all going to be divorced as well. So, you know, or not all single parents or co-parents or whatever. So I think from that, I kind of learned that adult relationships are not easy, you know, for us adults, us humans. And I think birth can put a particular kind of stretch on it. So I think it was about 2007 that I developed Relaxed Birth and Parenting, that ran classes, trained doulas, trained active birth teachers and yoga teachers. And I would go to lots of births and wrote a book about birth. And that took me to some lovely places like Brazil and Lithuania and worked quite a lot in those places. But I kind of feel like birth was my springboard, because as you both know, and we've talked about, when you're working with birth, you're really working with multi-layered, complex, all of life is in there, and all of relationships of life. The context of our history can be triggered. Our relationship can be put under new growth and also new strain and challenge. And I just think it's a very potent time, actually. Yeah. Very powerful time, but can be very vulnerable as well.
So in terms of kind of birth experiences, pregnancy experiences and new parenting experiences, adding a strain, adding a pressure, as well as adding a joy, what kind of things have you kind of commonly seen over the last 15, 20 years, like patterns or things maybe that new parents coming up behind might need to watch out for, as it were?
Yeah, I think I would like to really normalise the place at the table for vulnerability. I mean, I just think if we're giving birth and we're starting a new family or we're expanding the family we have, we have to pull up a chair to the table and say vulnerability will be here. But here for the partner, the father, the mother, you know, because it's such an enormous systemic change. And I think that often, especially I would say today, it feels to me that people can put themselves under enormous pressure, because when I was having my kids, there was no internet. Imagine that, no internet. Mm-hmm. And I think there can be an illusion, I will say, that if you read all the right books, got the right style of parenting and just did, you know, follow that, that it would be okay and you could sort of miss out being vulnerable or get it right. And I think that's setting oneself up for an enormous amount of pressure. I think it would be appropriate to feel really vulnerable through that transition for men partners and women, you know, because I think that it's just a whole new relationship. And I think so what would I say? I would say the context of it, exhaustion, low resource, time, finances, energy, all of those resources are going to be squeezed for the whole family in a way, aren't they? For the couple, if there's a couple, or one, you know, the single parent, if it's one person. And I think that when you squeeze those kind of resources, money, time, energy, sleep, we're definitely going to get more vulnerability. I mean, it's just inevitable. And I think that because if we're used to that, if we are used to relating to our own vulnerability and to the vulnerability of our partner, then I think, okay, we're off at a trot kind of thing. We could do it. But I think so many people haven't had to face real vulnerability necessarily in their relationship before they've had a child, because they're young and new and fresh and full of that enthusiasm. And you wouldn't necessarily have had to deal, for example, with conflicts. I guess some couples do. They might have had real health challenges, money, financial problems, or extended family problems, or work, career problems, and they might have had to work. They might be a blended family, or one's had kids and one hasn't. So they might have had to work with what we could call tricky topics, tricky, difficult things to talk about. But I would say that the fundamental thing I notice in the postnatal period is that many couples haven't had to learn and develop the means and the skills with which to develop process around tricky conversations. And I think if you can kind of get an agreement on how will we talk about these things, you know, non-blame, non-judgment, non-critical, speak from the I place, choose the best time and place, don't just do it when you're activated, wait till adrenaline is down, agree a limited period of time to try and talk, etc., etc. I think that people often haven't had to do that. So suddenly in a tired, weepy, you know, place, I think people can get overwhelmed, and then conflict can arise where there hasn't been conflict before, or it can be more volatile and escalated in a way that can feel really difficult because you're at your lowest ebb. That's one thing. How do people manage their conflict? And I always think that conflict is actually about diversity. It's about difference. You know, we love to be soul mergers, soulmates, soul mergers, same music, same politics, same dance anthems, whatever. We love that bit. We don't always like the relational growth aspect of relationships, I believe, where we will have to meet each other's differences. And I would say that postnatally, you might be merging in the love of the baby, maybe, but you're also probably going to be very much in your differences. And I think that often people can make meaning of other people's differences that is assumptive and not necessarily truthful without checking them out. And we can say, oh, I never knew you'd be the kind of person who would do da-da-da-da. Or people can have different ideas about breastfeeding, or different ideas about sleeping, or where the baby sleeps. And I think you can think that you've kind of prepared for everything and talked everything through. Possibly. I mean, who would have the time to do that? But some people might have a go at that. But there's always going to be things that are going to, you know, like actually that you're going to have to work out. So if you don't have a process and an agreement in place, then I think it can be very kind of tricky. I also think one of the things that I notice is that, you know, these days, men and women, partners, you know, whether it's single sex partnerships or heterosexual partnerships, everybody's working. You know, we're not in the 1950s or 60s here. You know, everybody's got purposefully engaged in their career and their education, in their study, in their life. And they all have very individuated interests. And suddenly, in a postnatal period, which I don't think you can really get away from. It's called physiology in a way, and, you know, difference. The woman is going to be impacted differently. And I think some people suddenly find themselves in a place where they never have before. So the woman might be reliant on partner in a way she never has been before financially and for support. Mm-hmm. And if she's a super independent, full of agency kind of being, that could be very problematic for her. And I think the partner can sometimes feel very alone in the burden of responsibility financially and carrying all those kind of adult concerns and going out into the world every day and feeling the weight of that burden sometimes. So I think, first of all, where you have real difference in a relationship, possibly for the first time ever, conflict could easily follow. Misunderstandings, assumptions, resentment. I always think resentment is like the bindweed of a relationship. I live with a gardener, so I'm going to use a lot of gardening metaphors. My husband's a gardener. So I'm always weeding the ground elder or the bindweed or the, what are we on now, buttercups at the moment. You know, so I feel like it's a poor cousin of anger, resentment, but it does kind of wrap itself into the roots and tug down joy. And it certainly gets in the way of emotional connection and empathy. So I think that anywhere in any relationship, the garden, you know, runs free with resentment, we need to weed it. So I think that if people haven't been able to manage conflict before, then they have to learn how to do that. But that's hard to do at a time when you're most exhausted. So sometimes you might say, we don't have the energy to really sort these things out. I think it can be a good time to be held by a couple counsellor, or if they can't hold themselves in that process, rather than letting things get escalated and more separate. Or I think it's a good time to even just say, we do have things coming up. This is a massive growth time for us. I'm feeling really overwhelmed in it. And you know, maybe we can just accept that as appropriate and normal at this time. And when things ease out a bit, we'll put some better attention to it. In the meantime, can we try and hold boundaries around basic respect and kindness? Because I think basic respect and kindness can get lost at a time when they're most needed. And I think that resentments can come in because people are in different worlds. You know, the guy might come in or the partner might come in and think, Christ, the place is a bomb site. You know, all she's doing is like hanging out with a baby all day, going and doing the job I'm doing out there. That looks like nothing. But of course, as any of us would know if we've done that, you know, you haven't had time for the pee, the loo, to chop food. It's difficult in the early days, isn't it? You're just 24/7 giving out and feeding and stuff. So I think that, the woman could be like, well, it's all right for you. You're out of work. You get lunch breaks and tea breaks and adult conversation and your career's soaring. And I think I would notice, having done this for about, 25, 30 years or odd, I would say that it feels to me that that's even harder sometimes for women today, probably because there is more equality today. We still have sexism and all the rest of it. But because there is more equality, I think sometimes young women can really struggle with not feeling resentful. But I think responsibility is key if you're feeling resentful. You know, am I communicating my needs? And did I choose to be pregnant? Do I choose to be at home with this kid? I'm not in that. I suppose I'm inviting in responsibility because it might settle resentment a bit. It's not forever. It's for a short period of time, you know. And it is a huge job, but I think if resentment gets to a certain level, above the water table kind of thing, then I think appreciation goes. And I think if mm-hmm. any relationship loses appreciation, because we're talking about oxytocin here, really, which you guys obviously know all about, then we're really in a dangerous place. You know, we're taking the juice out of a relationship, we're taking the blood out of it, we're taking the heart out of it, really. And I just think take the heart out of relationship when it's a little bit in a stretch. And that's a really dangerous place to go. Then I think what follows is evidence basing, you know, gathering the negative evidence as to why you're right and they're wrong. And you can feel like a victim because they're a piece of shit anyway. Excuse my language. You know, that kind of evidence basing. And I always think evidence basing is, again, a dangerous place to go because we'll gather the evidence for whatever we want to gather the evidence for. Are we gathering the evidence of where we are loved and supported, or are we looking for the evidence? I think another thing I would say is that when you have a child, a baby, it can really trigger historic stuff in that individual mm-hmm. person, whether it's the mother, the partner, the father. It can really trigger unresolved stuff. And I don't think that's a bad thing. And I don't think that means nobody did their work before they had their kids. I just think it's inevitable that the next layer of the onion will be stripped away when you have a baby. And you might think about the own mothering you received, or you might think about the fathering you received, or you might think about the mothering, you know, all of that kind of, some of it prenatal and postnatal stuff from one's own inner baby is triggered. So sometimes we won't understand the depth of emotion that we might feel around some of the things that we're trying to struggle with. So if we add that into the pot with the lack of sleep, finances stretched, maybe time stretched, diversity differences, because people have ultimately come from different historic situations and they are going to bring, I mean, ultimately we are different. You know, we are different in our individuated human sense. And I think that's very troublesome, you know. So I think I would say the vulnerability, making that safe and kind of normalizing that it's going to be a new and growthful time. And growthful times sometimes bring growing pains. So I think doing, like really grabbing hold of, how will I keep empathetic connection? Where do I notice I get resentful? Where do I notice that I gather evidence in a negative sense? Could I still, you know, it's a bit like, I think it's a John Lennon quote, you know, a plant, love is like a plant. You don't just put it away in the cupboard and bring it out when you want it. You've got to water it every day. And I think also all those kind of things about changing relationship dynamics, you know, people can have all kinds of fantasies, can't they, about what that postnatal period would feel like. And I think the more fantasies you have, the harder probably it's going to be. Some people want to do it totally different from their family of origin. Some people want to repeat their family of origin, add another family system, you know, coming in with something else. And that's kind of, it's quite tricky, isn't it? Would it be good for me to talk a little bit about sex?
We'd love to talk about that. We'd love to talk about how, you know, what have you noticed in terms of people's libido, and is it different, say, for one person in the relationship to the other? So, you know, the mother at home with the baby, classically, is she going to have a different libido to, say, potentially her partner? And what can they do when they notice these differences before they get into resentment?
I am a real fan of being able to talk about it, which you know, is a very tender and difficult thing, I think, for even lots of couples would really struggle to talk about sex, and libidos can get very defensive or blameful and attacking. And when we think about how vulnerable sex is in a way in a long-term relationship, I think we want to be really clear again on the process we're bringing, the ground we're offering for the conversations. So I think that, you know, really respectful ground rules, you know, but I think that, sometimes I think we feel uncomfortable about our own place in it. For example, if we went with that, a woman might feel like it wouldn't be so unusual to hear that a woman who's got a baby crawling all over her, suckling off her nipples pretty much 24/7, rarely coming out of her arms, or okay, maybe to sleep, but, you know, feeling like she's having a lot of physical contact. She's probably being sated in her physical intimate needs. Now, I wouldn't say that, you know, it's a very different thing, obviously, to sex and making love with a partner, but she is having a lot of touch and she might feel overwhelmed even by the amount of touch she's having, and that it's a real no-go area. And I guess you might ask, what would have been the context of the sex life before the postnatal period also? Like often in relationships, you'll have one who's more prone to initiate and one who's not. So I guess you've got to ask that, you know, is it an extension of what was there before, or is it somebody who loved sex before, initiated loads, and now is in a very different place? So we might, you know, that might need to be communicated. And I think one of the things that comes forward for me there is that often in our intimate adult relationship, it's such an easy place to project because they're just there. You know, they're almost part of you in a way. So you can have a feeling and then you can immediately seek to project. By that I mean you can have a feeling and then you can immediately see who you want to blame for that feeling, you know, and it's probably going to be them. And I'm going to encourage here that we just stay with the feeling of vulnerability, because I don't think sex, to be really clear from my lens, is ever about sex. It's not about the act, it's not about the anatomy, it's about, from my perspective, it's about vulnerability. And it's about being able to put resentment down. And in that way, I would say in a really long-term relationship, I'm not talking about a postnatal period here, but going forward, but maybe it's worth holding this in mind in a postnatal period. I'm as a relationship therapist, I'm a massive fan of having a sex life, if two people want that, in a long-term adult relationship. Kind of because I think in a mechanistic way, if I look at it purely neutrally as a systemic kind of mechanism that brings something to a relationship, I would say that you can't do it unless you put resentment down. Great. We've got a mechanism there that makes us check in our own resentment levels. Can't do it unless you feel safe in vulnerability. Great. You know, then okay. We've got to learn to keep trying to feel safe in our vulnerability in relationship, which is a good thing. It's free. You don't need a babysitter. If somebody is really resting in their parasympathetic nervous system or even goes forward towards orgasm, there is a physiological release that is very good for the body and the nervous system. And I think generally people feel closer, before than afterwards. It's also the one thing you do with your partner that unless you're in some polyamorous relationship, you're not going to be doing with anybody else. So it gestures the special sacredness of that union, you could say. And I think that one of the ways that relationships are wise to mature is that I could say, I'm angry with you and I can still be in loving connection with you. You're angry with me. I'm still available for empathetic connection. Because I think a younger place in relationships that we can all put our hands up to, even at the grand old age of 56, is I'm angry with you, therefore I'm withdrawing, or I'm angry with you, therefore I'm attacking. You know, well, no, actually, let's be really mature and go, I am angry with you. And I'm able to still be available to respectfully connect with you. So we're kind of making an assumption here that in the postnatal period, the woman doesn't necessarily have a libido like the guy. I would say it's not always like that for all women, but I would say many women would feel that. And I think, again, the bit that I would like to bring here is there can be a criticism or a subtle shaming of the partner or the man for even thinking there's a place for sex anymore in that year after birth. And I don't like that, because I just think they're not being touched all day and, you know, breastfeeding a baby. And maybe for some people, it's a very special place where they really connect in and feel the safety of their attachment, you could say. So you could say that if that person finds it hard to feel safely attached without sex, which is not so unusual, to be honest, it can happen, then I would say their grown up growing place is to grow that place where they can feel safely attached without sex. And together the couple can grieve and mourn and go, oh, it's so sad, we really miss that sex. You know, we'll get there one day again, but we're not there now. Like, I don't think shaming or judging somebody because they want to make love to their partner is a healthy thing. And I mm-hmm. think there's a little bit of a cultural shadow there where women might go, oh my God, guess what happened? They thought they were, you know. I just think, well, it's, you know, maybe that's because women don't always feel comfortable with their boundary and saying, you know what, it is a no from me, because actually I'm not in capacity, but I do feel sorry for that because I miss it too, or I hear you miss it. And I think then it's like when we take sex out of a relationship, what I've noticed is that there's a lot of secondary disconnections that can happen. So the person who might be advocating for the sex might stop advocating for the sex because they just don't want to be rejected anymore. Like, do you know what?
They're feeling vulnerable too now, right?
They are. And they're like, I don't want to be rejected anymore. So do you know what? I'm shutting that down. And the person who maybe isn't in the capacity for wanting to come together and make love could stop being physically gesturing, snuggling, hugging, leaning into, cuddling up naked, because they don't want to give the wrong message. But that's a very dangerous place, because then couples go like this. And by the time the baby's a year old or 18 months old or whatever, they can be in quite a wide disconnected place with a lot of miscommunications and assumptions in that place between them. So when I see a couple, they are not my clients as two individuals, actually. The space between them becomes my client. And I'm trying to understand what is fed into that space. So I think it can be a helpful reflection. I also think that if anybody's going off in their own head or hearing them say to a friend about how awful or how unsupportive or how outrageous their partner is, I always think it can be a good exercise. Try and imagine your partner has gone to sit in the room of a couple therapist and you're just sat there quietly watching and listening, and the couple therapist is asking your partner, tell me about your relationship. tell me what, how you find it. Tell me what's difficult about it. Tell me what's vulnerable in you, in your relationship. They might then be able to see through some of the difficult behaviours and patternings that's happened and trying to relate in a way to the vulnerability. But so again, I'm trying to skew our attention in a way to know that we will always probably be needing to make space to meet vulnerability through this period particularly. And that's humbling and that's difficult. And sometimes we don't want to make it really complicated and thinking about all the relational dynamics because we might not have head capacity and energy for that. So again, simple conversation that doesn't shame or judge, that acknowledges two people having a vulnerable time, you know, and can grieve together, can collaborate together on the growth of this new place. And there might be a challenge, a dilemma. How will we look after our adult relationship or our intimacy through this period? How will we? And nobody might have an answer, but I'm going to say, let's put it on the table. And luckily, we can go on with that conversation for as long as it takes. But if people are feeling, if the empathetic connection is looked after for both people, you know, then that really bodes well, doesn't it, for the kind of expansive growth of that relationship. So.
There was so much in that where I almost wanted to pause and write down what you were saying and break it down and take some of the key points. So I might have a go at doing some of that later, because I think there were loads and loads of helpful things in there that people could really think about and utilize. So thank you so much. I was really interested in the idea that, you know, you said you think sex is rarely about sex, and I can understand where you're coming from there. But often I think we wouldn't necessarily realize that. I think because it's such a tangible thing, it's easy to look at it and say, well, yes, it is, because it is.
It's literally this. I don't think it's about anatomy and physiology, you know, at all, actually. And I think we are sold that story. Put it this way, sometimes I might see couples who might be coming because maybe they haven't had sex for 5 years or something. And I've learned through time that always the most fruitful place to put attention would be their conflict patterns. Now, I don't know if that's an obvious connection. Is it an obvious connection? I don't know. It is to me now, in that, you know, if conflict has got out of hand and there's too much aggression and blame and criticism, well, there's not going to be sex because there's not going to be safety and vulnerability. If there's no conflicts, there's not going to be sex, because in a way you're not weeding your garden of resentment. You know, I'm not talking about abusive conflict there. I'm talking about doing conflict well, just saying I feel really upset about blah, 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 and hearing each other. So I do think it's we need to separate sex from being a mechanical kind of thing. So you've also heard me celebrate it as a mechanical thing that helps the nervous system to unwind. But really, and I think even if you didn't have sex and you were sated from your physicality by your baby being on your breast all day or whatever, you might still enjoy resting back together and just being naked together or physical together, especially if you knew there would be no pressure and your partner knew there would be no worry if they did get turned on. Because sometimes I think they can be worried about getting turned on, because if it's not going to go anywhere, oh my God, that would be exposing or rejecting. But it's like, well, if you haven't had sex and you miss it, you might get turned on. And if you're a man, you might have a hard on. But it doesn't mean that, you know, what I mean is that's quite exposing, isn't it? But if everybody knows that we're understanding where we all are, therefore we can cope with that, we can be with that, I just think everything can change. I mean, I have such a big heart for new families in that relational growth. You know, and I used to, in fact, I don't know if it's on my website at the moment, and I will put them on. It used to be on my old website, but I will put it on. But I remember when I was working at Relate, finding these rules for a row on the photocopier. And they're not my rules, and nobody said owned up to them being belonging to anyone, but I've used them ever since. When I used to do active birth workshops, maybe I can send them to you and you can start using them. I used to give them out in my active birth workshops. I'd be giving out all these handouts, you know, reflexology points, shiatsu for opening the pelvis, you know, and then along came rules for row, and everyone would be like, oh my God, why is she giving us rules for row? We're all loved up here and pregnant. What's your problem, love? But I think I would so often map back to miscommunications occurring from that time, that I really wanted to teach people to normalize that there might be some escalation of differences and difficulties, which could be conflictual, at a time when it's difficult, and also that there's a real place for agreeing on the process, like the rule, like we'll choose the best time and place, no name calling, I'm prepared to hear each other's sadness, disappointment, anger, or whatever's being felt, talking from the eye position, whatever those rules are. It doesn't, I don't say to people, these are the rules, but I say, have a look at these rules, chuck out the ones you don't like and add some new ones of your own, but do at least take responsibility for how you would like to shape having these conversations that you might find difficult.
So powerful, especially like how you said right at the beginning that you, most couples at that stage haven't had the practice of tricky situations. You know, we live in a sort of idealized society where everything's got to be so perfect, and actually genuinely we probably haven't had the practice, but actually a little bit of practice in a kind of safe space can go a long way at weeding the garden. So I really love all of your analogies. It's so good.
And one of the things we haven't talked about, which maybe just spend a few seconds talking about, is the birth trauma and how that affects the sex life. You know, well, it can be complicated for men and women, I believe, in that, can't it? It can be complicated for anybody, or partners and women, you know, for same-sex partnerships. You know, in that nobody wants to... Well, anyone might have their own experience of seeing their partner suffer or struggle in some way. And, you know, with perineal, you know, with perineal tears or episiotomies or cesarean scars, or, I mean, I think there is so much more awareness today on the one hand, but even just for a couple to come together and just sit down at some point in the, say, a couple of months after birth, or sooner if there's the energy, but while it's fresh, you know, if your vagina was talking to me, what would it say? I mean, probably people, I feel like sometimes doing the job I do, I'm just so direct that people are like, oh, you couldn't possibly say that, Dom, but I don't know. But, you know, if your cervix was speaking, what would it say? If your perineum had a word to say, what would it say to me? Because actually, somebody could be so uncomfortable and vulnerable in that experience that they don't even know how to find the words, really. And I think that we live in a very different generation now. You know, when I was being born, dads didn't go to birth. You know, my mum had her 7 kids, and I remember her saying, oh, my waters are gone in Dorothy Perkins, I'm going to drive myself in now. And my dad would be like, great, I'm going to have a game of squash, pick up the kids, you know, then we'll get the kids and we'll all come in and say hi afterwards. Bye. And off she went. I mean, wild. He was a caring dad, you know, but I'll go and play squash, you go and birth, we'll meet at the pub later kind of thing, you know, or whatever. Not the pub, but you know what I'm saying. So I think that these days, obviously, that's really different. And we need to find ways to look after that better then. And you could say that relationships are evolving and that men and women are allowed to be vulnerable. Men are allowed to be vulnerable and women are allowed to be vulnerable. Sometimes male libido goes down because they feel depressed with postnatal depression, so pressurized around finances or roles, or am I a good enough dad, or do I feel pushed out from the partnership between mum and baby and I don't have my place in this love relationship anymore? Or, I mean, there's so much there, isn't it? You could say almost every human quandary is there, you know, at that time in a vulnerable way, but also a possibility of really visioning and growing.
If there's people that have experienced birth trauma, whether they realise it or not, you think having a good chat with your partner within a few months, if not sooner, about how you're feeling.
And you can be held in that process. Like, there are lots of people that do that. I mean, I sometimes sit as one-offs with people and do that. Because there's also, it's also good to say to the partner, how is your experience? What do you feel left within that? You know, some women have pain after birth, don't they, during sexual intercourse? And no partner wants to cause their partner pain. So that's a difficult. I also think we have people like Helen Hodder and her colleague who works in the NHS. And Helen worked, she's a women's physio, and she works a lot with the bladder and the bowel and pelvic floor. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that can need some attention there. And I would just say, please, please don't struggle or suffer on your own. You know, I can see that, you know, Juliana Hounsfield, you know, the mummy MOT physios and osteopaths in Bristol, you know, Tanya Russell, Neve, you know, well, so many of them, Laura, I mean, there's so many at the family practice, happens to be where I work, and I see all those osteopaths, I see the way they learn and work, and how much more information and science and understanding is available today than was. I think there's lots of places, but I think that even to go and be held as a couple to talk that out and through, you know, because actually sometimes people can feel overwhelmed, a partner, and not knowing how to be around that. but they don't have to know. So I suppose I would say in a growthful place, surely we're all allowed to not know. Let's also, you don't have to be an expert. You don't, you know, have to read every book and learn how to be a perfect parent. I do believe there is something essential in all of us if we can learn to take the time and be patient and respond to ourselves in a kind, respectful way, we will find our way to mother in the way that we're going to do it, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm. And Dom, do you find that couples might particularly struggle if they are kind of maybe more isolated, maybe geographically they're not near close friends or family, or they're the first ones out of all their friends to have babies? Do you see that if people have got more support and they can call in the troops a little bit?
I definitely think you need your tribe, you know, when you have a child, don't you? And I think that you're wise to also create a new tribe of friends and supporters. And I guess people are so busy today, I think, even in postnatal period, actually, weirdly, that's not always obvious and easy. When I think back to that time for myself, I certainly feel like I met some women who, in my antenatal classes, like the classes you do, I think it's fundamental to get your tribe. And I would say those women, in fact, I saw one of them today, 33 years ago, we met in a baby massage class with Peter Walker at the Active Birth Centre, which was lovely. And there we are, you know, and now we're good friends, and we've ended up living in the same part of England. So, because she was in London, I went to Bristol then. But so I do think that it's really important. I think having family around is really helpful if your family is really helpful. Of course, if you don't necessarily have the easiest relationship with your extended family or your partners, then that can have its own problems, because you can feel that they overstep boundaries that you know, I also hear a lot and work a lot with that with couples, how to manage that. And I think you've got complications even post-birth, where a woman might say, I want my mum to come and stay because I need that help. Mm. But your mum is that person's in-law. And they might say, I want my mum to come because I'm becoming a dad or a parent and I need that support. But you're the woman who's birthing might not want you know, it's like we've got to kind of try and think relationally, as I call it, and systemically. You know, the decisions I make affect those around me. And I think the pandemic, I definitely think for many was difficult. And I hear from some made it really easy, weirdly, because it was just they were at home. Nobody else was doing anything. The pub was closed. The nightclubs were closed. The theatres were closed. The friends weren't meeting and gathering. You know, so they, in a way, the sort of boundary of it all kind of made it easier for them to inhabit that role, just like a little unit at home, and it got quite cozy. And then for other people, they might have really struggled with the isolation. And again, I guess I would say that we couldn't make any one generalization, but whatever is your thing, I'd be surprised if your thing doesn't come up postnatally, you know, whatever that is. And I think it can be really helpful finding some mums that are older sometimes, if they can bring some lovely wisdom. I remember meeting an older mum in that baby massage class who had three kids and was a lot older than me. I was just 23 and she was probably in her late 30s, and she was just absolutely a, you know, such a godsend to me, because she would just be so kind and help me to just say, do it your own, you know, do it your own way. Because I think people can be swayed around a lot, can't they? And I think that ultimately, you know, you could say you're going to do it this way or that way, but even this way or that way will be, you know, there'll be a million ways to do it. Like I could say I'm an attachment parenter, but I'm going to have there's going to be a thousand different ways that people will make sense of that, won't they?
I feel like this is a time where people may have to give up some of those ideas that you talked about, the fantasy as well. And we might all have very clear ideas before we become a parent of what kind of parent we're going to be. And none of that takes into account the lived experience and the kind of evolutionary aspects of it that kick in for you, or as you were saying, the recalling things from your family of origin that you may not even be aware of. There's so many variables that can come into play with that. So, you know, you only need more than one child to know no baby is the same. And, you know, you might have been a very certain kind of parent to one child and be a completely different type of parent to another child, because that's what they've needed, and learning how to cope with that. And also you've grown, you've been on your own journey as well. I think this, you know, talking about all these variables and all these potential areas for conflict, you know, with that comes growth, and therefore the person's changing. So the person that you were with when you first fell pregnant on both sides is not necessarily going to be the same person. And How do you manage that? How do you allow for people to change without feeling threatened? How do you support each other during those times?
I mean, I think it's really a good thing just to notice when one gets activated. Like, that's such a basic way that we can at least begin, you know, to begin to work with our own. How activated do I get when my partner shares something around, say, feeding? Or do I shut it down? Do I defend against it? Do I not want to hear anything about it? Because that's not helpful, even if you feel so passionate. And also, I think I would say, you know, my kids are 35, 30 and 25. 33, sorry. 33. I think he's 33. 30 and 25. They're pretty old. And I know that I was passionate and very opinionated. And I don't think I was trying to get it right. I definitely wasn't. I think the one thing about being 22 and pregnant, 23 birthing, is that I probably wasn't reading 1,000 books about how to do it. I was just cracking on and having a go kind of thing, which probably is a bit liberating. But I still think that there's some sort of reactivity in that. So I was what I would probably call an attachment parent or whatever. But, you know, I could certainly hear my kids say, you know, all that endless breastfeeding. I think I breastfed them for a few. I think I was breastfeeding and pregnant for about 10 years of my life. So it was a bit extreme. But I never set off that. I didn't think, oh, I'm going to be a this or a that. And I now these days would be much more humble about that. Because I think there was a bit of me that thought, I'll do that because that is the right way, because I believe in attack, you know. And now I really wouldn't, you know, I've got, you know, like, I just think that you can't make those kind of assumptions. You know, one of my kids, my youngest, finds it hard to get sleep. And she's like, God, if only you'd just done some sleep training with me. It would have been so helpful as a baby. Why didn't you leave me down an alleyway and let me cry a bit, you know?
God, I mean, you know, Mom. You're not going to get anything.
Like, you know,
thing when I didn't,
but then Dom,
you know, uphold a boundary around a sort of dessert or something about, you know, and he just said he felt so existentially disappointed that I'd soften the boundary. Like, you know, oh, fuck, you know, I mean, we're not going to get it right. You know, you could line up my three kids and they're going to give them, I got wrong. So
we've got to give them something to go to therapy when they're 35 with, don't you, Dom?
Exactly. Well, I'm sure I gave loads, you see, is what I'm saying. And I probably thought I was doing a great job, but you know. But I would say...
But we're all doing the best we can with the information and tools we've got at the time, right?
Our preferences, histories, personalities, neurodiversity. I mean, we're allowed... Mm. You know, I also strongly believe that baby said, right, that one, I'll have her. She'll be the one. I'll zip in there and, you know, not to be totally hippie about it. But, you know, I do think there's some kind of soulful choosing for a soul to come through somebody. You don't have to agree with me, but... I wonder whether that's true.
I actually agree with you, Dom.
You know, so in a way, they picked you with all your package of, you know, whatever that is.
Foibles.
Exactly. And that's something, isn't it? And I feel very grateful to my kids that they helped to refine me, you know, by smoothing off my rough edges sometimes. In the same way that relationships do, I think all relationships are sandpaper to our rough edges. And if we kind of remember that, you know, we might then remember the humility of it.
Oh,
I think it's great what you're doing. I love that you're supporting postnatal families and antenatal families and putting all this out there. I think it really, really brings great joy to me.
I'm wondering, in a relationship that feels like it's deteriorated so much that perhaps there's no going back, or maybe that's how they feel, maybe they're at that stage where they're really wondering, do I want to fight for this relationship? Do I want to put the work in to make it work? Or is it easier now to walk away? What would you say to people who are really questioning, you know, maybe this idea, this is just so hard, it shouldn't be this hard, therefore it's probably wrong, or something along those lines?
I would say that, yes, relationships, all relationships can be that hard, all of them. There's not like a good one out there that wouldn't be that hard. It's not like, you know, swap the person, you know, if you only make the person wrong and difficult, say, you know, I mean, I also think, look, I separated from the father of my boys and then I started another relationship that I am still in. I mean, I had a little time in between on my own, you know, with my boys, and we co-parented together. And I think it was honestly truthful for us. It was a very harmonious kind of separating because we were very young when we got together. And I guess we just, you know, grew a little bit apart in certain kind of ways, and we were good friends, and I'm still a good friend with him now, and I'm grateful that he's the father of the boys and I can bring him up. And, you know, I think there's a place to end things. I remember once hearing this phrase, never separate in the first 5 years of life, you know, like in the first 5 years of postnatal. And though that seems quite long, 5 years, if it's really difficult, I would agree that it's certainly for the first 2 years, I think I would say, there's such a lot going on that you could be reacting to vulnerability, unable to be with your own vulnerability or somebody else's. And that doesn't mean the relationship is broken. And if you only made the other person wrong, you're probably just going to find, lo and behold, 5 years later in a new relationship, you've got exactly the same issues.
Actually looked at yourself.
Exactly. So let's not pretend that, you know. Having said that, I feel that I'm always working with relationships. In my relationship work, there's no goodies and baddies. I work systemically and relationally. Everybody has to look at what they put into that relational space. There are two things that I think overstep a boundary and therefore ask for more accountability and more responsibility. And that would be any kind of violence. Domestic violence is out. You know, it's just, so if someone was in a violent relationship, then I wouldn't say that you wouldn't be going, oh, let's wait the 2 years or, you know, I mean, everybody has to keep themselves safe. That is their responsibility as an adult and their child, obviously. And the second is affairs. In that they leave great bruises. So I think I wouldn't make an assumption about that. Lots of people heal wonderfully from affairs and even domestic violence, but both people have to be really willing and accountable and responsible. So I suppose if those things were on, but I think that if it's really difficult, I would say the first port of call would be to get some professional to help hold you in that process. And I know it's a very expensive process often. I would say Relate has concessions. Relate gives people couple therapy for very low cost. There's probably a big waiting list. Otherwise, if somebody can't afford it, if they had a really wise friend, they could go to the wise friend and say, would you feel it would be possible for you to mediate something, you know? Mm-hmm. I think it's really good for people to be honest in their heads. Where are they going? Because lots of people go off about how awful it is, but it's all in their heads. They never actually tell the other person until they're like, I'm over this now. It's gone too far. And I kind of can understand the other person's disappointment when they go, I wish you told me, because they actually would have loved to have worked with you on that. And now you're telling me it's too late.
Mm. So more open communication day to day, just with the little things like, oh, that happened. I feel rubbish about it. And just kind of do the weeding as you go rather than wait for a massive jungle in the garden.
And I think even just saying, I'm noticing that I'm really running to blame. I'm noticing that I'm really struggling. And I'm noticing that I just feel so angry with you so much of the time. And I don't want to be in that place. Could we try and sit down together and talk? Notice the I's in that and the we, but no you's.
Yeah. So it has, you didn't say you did this, you did that.
Or you always. That's never honest, is it? You're never supportive. You've always been dishonest. You've never helped me. You've never loved me. I just don't feel loved. Well, just because you don't feel loved doesn't mean the other person isn't loving you. It just means you're not feeling it. So maybe there's a language communication there problem.
Or maybe there's some bruising that's happened that, you know, she needs to do, or he needs to do some self-counselling.
Yeah. And I just think it's very, gives you a real sense of unease when you're not okay in your relationship. You know, a lot of evidence would say that. Well, a lot of evidence that would say about long-term relationships, that long-term well-sustaining relationships are, it's not about not having conflict. It's about being able to manage the conflict well, leave less bruises, hold it more lightly and resolve it quicker. That's what research would say. So, you know, that's the answer. And yes, relationships are hard. When people say, if it's this hard, it can't be good. Well, I don't know. It depends what you're bringing in yourself. It might be really hard and it might be good.
Yeah. Like you say, growth and growing pains.
Do you think sometimes baby brings a new perspective in as well? As in, perhaps prior to having the baby, someone might be content to work really, really hard to try and make the relationship fit in a way that they're hoping is going to work. And then they have the baby and actually that filter is removed and they're like, oh, this should never have even, you know, we didn't ever really work. And now I've not got the energy and I've got priority. My baby is now the priority.
Totally. Totally. And I know it's hard to be a single parent, you know. Luckily, I believe we live in a world where there's a lot less shame for people being single parents than in past decades, where some people have really, really suffered with feeling shamed by being a single parent or being the child of a single parent. As far as I'm concerned, a family is just a family can be one person and her dog. A family can be one person and her garden. I mean, for me, I would like every individual to define family for themselves. It might be them and their friends. I certainly feel no lack with a parent and one child, or a parent and two children. I don't think there's any lack in being a single parent family, or a co-parenting family, or a blended family. Or I love to celebrate blended and diverse and all of that. And I think some of the best human beings come from really blended, diverse kind of, because they've had to work with that. They know that people are different. You know, kids that go to different households learn something about different households. I think that's a really helpful, useful thing. So I think it's a lot about really actively, it can be a very powerful thing to be a single parent. I don't look at it as a victim type place. I think it can be wonderful, powerful, you know, just another version of a good family, right? And I think you're right. You know, people might, if people were afraid of that through a fear place or a shame place, I would support people to know that staying in a relationship which really doesn't have legs, because one person really isn't willing to do the work, you know, and is maybe abusive or just very childlike and unable to take the responsibility that is needed in order to be that parent, you know, if they're just not willing to do that, then, you know. And I think that, again, if it feels difficult to know how to navigate that way, I would say a professional can really help that. Like, sometimes you're helping to get a relationship back on track in a good way. Sometimes you're helping people to separate in a good way and find clear, you know, roles and responsibilities and boundaries around co-parenting. I work with lots of co-parents, and I think you can do co-parenting really well. You know, I think it can work brilliantly.
I think you're absolutely right. And knowing friends that have been co-parented and friends that are co-parenting, I just think there's so much richness that can be found there. And we're living in a world now where this is so much more normalized, and the stigma is not what it was. And I think there's going to be generations of children growing up with the benefit of having parents that aren't together, and feeling the positivity of more family members coming in. I would love to just ask you, but I think there's going to be a lot of people sort of my age and older who perhaps have been in relationships for a really long time, 15, 16, 17 years plus. And in terms of connecting sexually, maybe they got over that very difficult period of having little ones, and they've rode that wave, and now they're coming to a new phase in their lives. And what would you say to them about perhaps reconnecting sexually if there's been a period where they haven't really, or maybe they're finding things a bit stagnant?
I think it's a real challenge, isn't it? I think that's normal and appropriate. So let's normalize that for a start off. I would say that doing some new things, like regularly doing something new together, can bring a new lens on it. Whether that's a new food thing, a new restaurant, a new walk, a new song. It doesn't have to be a big thing, a new theatre thing or a... I think that it's very easy for long-term couples to become just roles and responsibilities. Do you really see your partner as someone separate from all that? How would you, you know, sometimes I think it would be nice to see your partner flirting with somebody or something. I mean, I'm not being obtuse in some way there, but I feel like, do you look at them as a sexual being with other people? Would you think they're attractive? You know, what do you find attractive about them? Secondly, always looking at the resentment thing. If resentment is low level resentment, which is so easy to creep in, is there, have a bit of a, you know, let's do something else. Let's go for a walk. Let's clean out our resentment baskets, play a new game, you know. Also, the recognition that you never know your partner. You can't think you know them. If you know them, you're going to be making assumptions in your head. You're in the process of getting to know them, maybe through life. So try and learn something new about them. You know, and then I just think that doing really kind gestures, especially, maybe that's a little bit more female led. You know, I don't want to make generalizations, especially I might be shot down for that around men and women, gender generalizations. But a lot of research would suggest that women in their physiology need to have a little bit of sexual currency or frisson through the 24-hour periods, not just in the bedroom.
It could just be putting the bins out. Put the bins out without me saying anything, and I'm all yours.
I definitely would say to both partners, feeling seen in your areas of struggle is probably going to feel sexy. I don't think that comes to people's minds. I don't think that necessarily your partners would go, when I see you, Claire's, in your most vulnerable places, I know it's a bit of a turn on for you. When I love and see and accept you in that place. But I also think gestures of massage, if you like that body work, day trips, if you can't go on holidays. I remember not having many a year, not going away with my husband. And obviously when I met him, I had two boys already. I mean, they would go to their dad's for a few days and stuff, and we were co-parenting, but we never had that time together without having kids, because there was always those two and then my daughter came along. So, you know, I have to say now, bloody marvellous going away, you know, because you're out in different places walking and talking, you know, and it's just feeding you in a new, and I love this phase of relationship. And I think I want to say laughter, we would say, wouldn't we? Music, laughter, newness, freshness, sensuality. If you can get in the sex into it again, I think then that can get onto a good new loop, a good new role.
And I read a little bit, Dom, about those five love languages. You know, I can't remember what they all are, like gifts and words of endearment and, yeah, actions. And that we can be a bit mismatched, you know, one of you might like one thing and the other like another thing. So you might always be not quite communicating on the same love language. Does that make sense?
Definitely. And I think what I would add to that is I'm always fascinated by couple fit. Always fascinated. Why did that person pick the person they picked? And I always think that they actually pick them for the difficult aspects of the relationship as well as the good bits, because the challenges will relate in some way to their own history. And if they can catch that, that it gives a little shadowy feeling, a homeopathic kind of sense of an old issue, but felt again, you know, not in the same, you know, way, then mm-hmm. it gives you an opportunity to heal that, doesn't it? Don't be afraid of the difficulties either. You know,
sorry. Some people gather. Do you ever notice, Dom, that sometimes the thing that we were most attracted to in our partners ends up being the thing that we resent the most later on?
Totally. You know, so say someone loved what?
Say,
give me an example,
your partner loved going out and being the social butterfly, the centre of attention, out all the time, has loads of friends. And then when your kids come along, you're like, stop going out all the time. Talking from personal
exactly.
experience.
100%. And I always think that that's an interesting one. And though one can say, I am now in a place where I find that really difficult, we don't want to suddenly judge and go after a partner for who they are.
Mm.
That would feel like really disrespectful. You know, sometimes people like say might pick someone they loved because they were like an amazing camera person, wildlife camera person, but then with that job you're away on shoots all the time.
Yeah,
well obviously before you had kids, you that person had promised to give up that job and then they didn't, that would be a different thing. But if they never said they were going to give it up, they've always loved to be a cameraman, they spent all of their life waiting to be a camera person, and they are, they're not suddenly going to give it up when they have kids if that's not what you've agreed. So why would you suddenly be like ranting and raving about, you can say, I find the lived experience of it much harder than I thought. Mm-hmm. What can we do to help this? Of course. But so often, like you say, we go after the very thing that drew us to them, which is a bit unfair, I think.
Ironic, interesting. And
you can always say, what am I being invited to grow in the place where I feel challenged by my partner?
Yeah, what is all this teaching me?
Yeah, what am I trying to, and how does that relate to my own history?
We have three questions that we like to ask our guests, one of which is our little guilty confessional. Not necessarily guilty, but the idea that we can dispel some of the myths or ideas about what it is to be a yoga teacher in our case. But maybe you could give us an example of where something in your life or something you do that doesn't fit in with the narrative of being a therapist or being a yoga teacher or an active birth teacher or something like that.
I'm a therapist and I really celebrate. I'm because I work so much with families and couples, I would say I'm passionate about celebrating diversity, you know, neurodiversity, but also just our differences of patterning, histories and behaviours. And the secret would be, and I can be incredibly judgmental and assumptive in my own family situation.
Oh, that's great to hear. and the other question we have is, we believe each of our babies brings us a gift, maybe a perspective or a talent we didn't have before, or a quality, a personality trait. Do you agree? And do you know what your babies brought you?
Well, I mean, they're all very different. And I would definitely say that I have a very different journey probably with each of them. And I mean, I do learn incredible gifts from all of them. And I feel like what I really value is just the celebration of difference, that we still kind of wrangle sometimes, and it can be difficult sometimes and wonderful sometimes and all in between and everything, but that we are all still in there, you know, having a go of refining ourselves in our relationships. And they all bring different things. And I totally agree with you. The way they're born, you know, my first son initiated me into birth, and it wasn't the easiest birth. And I am grateful to him, because some people say, oh, that was a difficult birth, a bad birth. I would never say that. I would say, my goodness, that boy initiated me into the enormity and the amazing things of birth. And my second child, unattended home birth, midwife didn't get that, you know, supper with Janet. And, you know, he was teaching me something else, wasn't he, that I could just fly on, you know, my daughter, Miss Gem, and I, it was a sunny day, didn't we have a few friends and a few kids and a few who out there, I think my ex was out in the garden with the boys, and, you know, there was a whole celebratory party going on there. She's a double Gemini, it's going to be a bit, you know, like that. So I feel like everyone has their different quality and brings it, and I love that. And I feel like, you know, some of our kids will press our buttons more than others, and that's okay too, you know, that we can love and respect that just as much as the one place where we might feel a bit more easy and resonant.
Brilliant. And is there anything you're feeling grateful for in your life right now?
Well, I'm feeling really, really grateful for, especially right now, because I have moved on from day-to-day parenting and stuff. I'm passionate that I just kept chugging away when I was a mum, you know, doing my work. But it was part-time because I was quite involved with my kids. And that wasn't always easy, you know. Wasn't always easy for me. My husband's a gardener, and, you know, that wasn't always easy financially and stuff like that. But I feel so grateful that, in a way, I just kept going with what I loved and was passionate about. And I think if you work around birth, you two will know that you tend to follow what is really very heartfelt, mm-hmm. you know, and very passionate. And now it turns out I earn my living doing what I absolutely love, can't learn enough about, and I learn from the people I work with, the clients. And so I'm feeling enormous gratitude for that. I really am. Because if you'd asked the 20-year-old me, would I like to be doing what I do now? She'd be like, oh my God, yes. And it wasn't like I was really a strategic kind of person, because that's not the way my mind works, but I follow my passion and my heart, and now I am doing, you know, I am doing that, so I'm very grateful for that.
Well, we're really grateful you do it too, Dawn, and thank you so much for coming and sharing that with us.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me, and you know, if you come up with another topic and we can have another chat another day kind of thing.
That would be wonderful. Thank you so much, Dom. It's just been brilliant.
Ah, lovely to meet you, Claire, too. And I love it that it's the two Claires. I love it.